We live in, as we understand, as we know, and we see, observe every day, a very dangerous and a violent, confused world. When we look around at things that are happening in this society, we notice that there's so much that's taking place that is just so complicated and so confused and so difficult. And we realize that many of the situations that the world is dealing with right now are absolutely impossible to solve. Last week in the sermon we saw, Mr. Franks emphasized that point very emphatically, that the world is not the way it's supposed to be, not the way God intends for it to be, and it's in a condition that is beyond anything that people can do to solve. There are many different areas of life that are so complicated and confused and beyond human help. You can look at issues like racism and bigotry that are so deeply embedded in people's thinking and character that in this life it's not going to be solved. Even things like the world economy and the oppression of people who are in need by those who have more than they need. The world is unbalanced in so many ways and looking at so many issues that cannot be resolved. And one of the areas in this world that we look at that is so twisted and so convoluted and so beyond human ability to deal with is the situation we find in the Middle East. The nations in that region who are in constant conflict and warfare and have been as long as anyone can remember, and it is beyond what can be done by mankind to solve it. It seems that every Sabbath we can look back on the previous week and review a whole list of terrorist attacks or terrorist threats that take place in the nation or the state of Israel, in nations in that region such as Iraq, Afghanistan, other nations in Europe, and the constant fear and threat of terrorism within our nation and against American resources such as embassies and the military and even American citizens traveling abroad are targets for terrorists. The question is, how did that come to be? Why is there so much bitterness and hatred between the peoples of the Middle East? Along with a list of other unsolvable issues, this is one that stands out as one of the most significant. The brutal violence that we see in the Middle East in general, and it reaches into Northern Africa and into Western Asia and over into Europe, that whole section of the globe, of the nations, the brutal violence that exists in those areas is primarily between two distinct cultures. On the one hand, Arabs and Muslims. On the other hand, Christians and Jews and those of the Western democracies, people from Europe, United States, the State of Israel. It's a clash of culture as well as a clash of religion. But how did it become so violent? How did the world become so dangerous and so divided as it is, especially in that region? We've been reviewing, in recent messages, a couple of them, a general theme they're going to follow up on or continue today. And I titled this series, The Origins of Terrorism. How did things come to be the way they are? Why is it that it's such a confused and worrisome part of our life today? So again, this is part three of the series that I've titled Origins of Terrorism. The simple answer is found in Genesis 25. We're going to review a bit of what we've talked about in the previous messages and pick it up and take it a few steps further this afternoon. But the simple answer to how the world got to be as it is today in terms of this division this clash, is found here in Genesis chapter 25. In verse 21, we read that Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, when a woman is pregnant, of course, there's always some movement in her womb as the baby develops and grows and occasionally stretches around a bit, goes for a jog. There's always something happening, it seems, and that's actually can be the sign of a healthy fetus awaiting or growing and getting ready for its birth. But this was much beyond that. There was such a difficulty that she was having. It wasn't as if a baby was just moving. There was a struggle taking place within her womb. In fact, we'll see that it wasn't just even just a normal movement or struggle. It was a confrontation that was taking place. And she knew that something wasn't right. She said, "Why am I like this if all is well?" So she inquired of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb." Now, some ladies have fairly large babies. Two nations are within your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. These twin boys that were born to Rebekah represent the bitterness and the hostility that developed through the centuries, through the millennia, between two peoples, two nations that were within her womb. And they became the two dominant cultures in the world today. They struggled with each other before they were even born. And notice as we read about them that they are completely different. Now, parents know that when you have children, they can be very different. They can have different appearance, different personality, different temperament, even twins. But this was not an ordinary difference between them. There was a bitterness and a hostility that started or that was present in their relationship even before they were born. Verses 24 and 25 describe their birth. We'll drop down to verse 27. It says, "So the boys grew, and we see as they grew that they were completely different kinds of young boys and men. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field." Esau was the quintessential outdoorsman. He lived in the wilderness. He lived by his own physical strength and abilities. He was a hunter, and he was an outdoorsman through and through. Jacob, it says, was a mild man dwelling in tents. Now, we've reviewed this scripture once before and pointed out that being a mild man didn't mean that he was weak or that he didn't have any strength about him. The word mild would be better translated complete. Esau was unbalanced, frankly. He just was this rough outdoorsman who just didn't have a lot of other maybe domestic skills or sensitivities. But Jacob was a complete or a balanced person. And he lived in a civilized way. He lived in tents. So Jacob and Esau are inherently different in their nature, in their personality, in just the kind of people that they are. And we'll note as we read through their story, as you're familiar with, that they were never able to live together peacefully. Now, siblings can have their rivalries and their squabbles, and sometimes families get complicated and it can become pretty serious differences between them. But this, again, is an exaggerated situation where they never lived at peace with one another. The family was divided. Isaac loved Esau, and Rebekah loved Jacob. And so the whole family was divided because of or by the different nature of these two boys and as they grew into men. Jacob, for example, was seemingly always taking or doing what he could to take advantage of his brother Esau. On two major occasions, we see that Jacob took advantage of him to take from him, to in effect buy from him, his birthright. And later, Jacob stole the blessing. Now you look at it and you wonder, well, why was that necessary? The prophecy about them, and back in 25, verse 23, was that the older would serve the younger. God had in mind that Jacob would be the dominant of the two. But Jacob seems to be one who was always getting ahead of where he should have been, at least at this point in his life. And he took from Esau what Esau felt should have been his. So Esau felt cheated out of these family blessings, the birthright, and then later the covenant blessing itself that was handed down by his father Isaac. And there was not just a sibling rivalry, there was a sibling bitterness that grew between them. We skip ahead to chapter 27, verse 41. This is stated after Jacob had stolen the blessing by pretending to be Esau. Verse 41, it says that Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. The blessing that was given to Esau, we'll read in a few minutes, compared to the blessing that was given to Jacob. Esau hated his brother. And he said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand." In other words, Isaac, my father, is older. He's going to die soon, and after he dies and the period of mourning is over, it says, "Then I will kill my brother Jacob." So this was an intense feeling of hostility that had developed between the two of them. Esau was determined to kill his brother. And we'll see as we continue that the descendants of Esau still have that same perspective, that it is their desire to kill the descendants of Jacob. So as we look at the situation in the Middle East, it's not just a matter of what happened in 1948 when the British established the state of Israel. It's not just what happened in the 1968 war when Israel defeated Egypt. And it isn't just what's happening on the coast there, where the Palestinians are attacking Israel, trying to get their homeland back. This is a conflict that goes back to the beginning of civilization. It was something that developed, and the cultures that came from these two nations that were within Rebekah have led to the circumstances that we see today. And along the way, it has become so entangled by the specific events and circumstances, and also entangled because of the different religions that each of these two cultures have adopted. Actually, there are three different religions that between the two cultures, that has even made it more difficult and beyond any human solution. Again, it was God's plan all along that the older, that Esau, would serve the younger. He would serve Jacob. But the intense rivalry between the brothers has led to circumstances that are so entangled and so violent today. ultimately, what we want to do is to go through the history of these peoples and then take a look at where they stand today, but maybe most importantly, look into the future. See what the Scripture says about prophecy for this region. And we'll better understand those prophecies by having a good handle on the history of what happened and how it came to be as it is today. So we're still at the stage of exploring the history of these two and the development of the cultures that we that have emerged in our world today. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 12. And we'll see here, and by the way, I know that you've just gotten your booklet, the United States and Britain and the Commonwealth in Prophecy. And much of what we're talking about, what we started in this series, is, of course, covered in that booklet. So maybe I'm repeating something that you've already just read about recently. But we'll continue with the discussion that we began some time ago about the history of this and the development of these cultures and what lies in the future. And, of course, the booklet provides an excellent and probably a much better summary of what is to be, what has happened and what is to be expected. Genesis chapter 12 is where we find God first beginning to work with Abram. It says in 12:1 that the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country from your family and your father's house to a land that I will show you." Now, one thing that's missing from this story is the relationship that Abram must have already had with God in order for him to be so quick to respond. It doesn't tell us how Abram came to know God, how Abram initially responded, or how it is that he had come to put his trust and his faith in him. But when he was told to leave his own country, his own homeland, and his family, and go to a land that I will show you, then that's what he did. Initially, it doesn't even say where he's going to be sent. But God says, I'll show you. You just pack up and leave, and we'll talk about where you're going to land when you're on the way. Verse 2, I'll make you a great nation, and I'll bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, and you and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram responded as God had given him direction. It says in verse 4 that he departed as the Lord had spoken to him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their possessions and all that they had gathered and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem. God in instructing or telling Abram that he should leave and go to this new land that God would give to him made a couple of promises that Abram was willing to accept. But there were a couple of details that still needed to be worked out. See, Abram is 75 years of age, yet he and his wife have no children. God had told him that he'd be the father of a great nation, and that families of nations would come from him. But at this point, even at this age, he had no children. He had no heirs. He had no descendants. And secondly, there's another problem. As we look here at the end of verse 6, he goes through the Shechem into the Terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were in the land. The Canaanites were already there. The Canaanites were in the land that God told Abram his descendants would inherit. Where do the Canaanites come from? How is it that they were already in this area that Abram was being told his descendants would inherit? Well, let's back up about 400 years or so. Go back to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis 10 lists the genealogy of Noah through his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The flood was probably close to 500 years prior to the time that God began to work with Abram. And so civilization had begun to develop, and peoples were beginning to spread throughout the region and to inhabit the land. And chapters 10 and 11 here in Genesis give us some of the background of those people. For a moment, let's just take, first of all, look at chapter 11. We see something in verse 10. This is the genealogy of Shem. Shem, of course, again, being one of the three sons of Noah. We're not going to read all these inexplicable names here for the next several verses. I want to drop down to verse 24. And we'll pick up the thread here of the descendants of Shem. It says that Nahor was 29 years and he begot Terah, or lived 29 years, begot Terah. And after he begot Terah, he lived another 119 years. Verse 26, Terah lived 70 years and he begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So we'll note as we begin that Abraham is a descendant of Shem. And that was the son of Noah, whose family Abram is born from or come from. So now, with that thought in mind, just as kind of a side point, let's go back to chapter 10. We're looking for the Canaanites. How did they come to dwell in this land of where that had been promised to Abram's descendants? Genesis 10, verse 6. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And so the descendants of Ham through these four sons is traced. Notice in verse 8 that Cush, one of the sons of Ham, begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty hunter on the earth. One of the descendants through the line of Ham is Nimrod. Now, that's a name that we certainly have heard before. Nimrod was the origin, or through him we can trace the origin of the, many of the pagan gods of the land. And he was one of the people who originated the religion, the false religions that Satan established after the flood. And the pagan gods of this region originated, many of them, through Nimrod. And these pagan gods would plague Israel throughout their history. Now notice verse 13. Lists again several of the descendants, and it says that, dropping down to the end of the verse, it's talking about Pashurim and Cashelin, and it says, from whom came the Philistines? So the Philistines are also descendants of Ham through Cush. And so we would come across them frequently as well in this history of Israel. And now verse 15. Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. And then we come to the Ite family. The Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, and so on. The descendants of Canaan, those who lived in the area of Canaan, included these tribes that are listed here. And these are the tribes of Canaan that were in the land when Abram was told that he would be inheriting, or his descendants would be inheriting that territory. Again, as it said in chapter 12, verse 7, Canaanites were in the land. They were descendants of Ham through one of his sons named Canaan. So these were the people who populated the land that Abram was promised. Look ahead here to chapter 15, verse 18. Chapter 15, verse 18. God again is promises the land to Abram's descendants that are occupied by the Canaanite tribes. Chapter 15, verse 18, on the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates. And then it lists the Ites who lived in that land before them, the Canaanite tribes that lived in this region. So from the time after the flood to the time of Abraham, which again spans more than 400 years, probably close to 500 years, these tribes grew and developed and established themselves and became, they established themselves in the land that was going to be given to Abraham and to his descendants. So the land is already filled with these Canaanites. Now the Canaanites initially were not enemies of Israel or of Abraham's descendants. They didn't become enemies until Israel tried to displace them. Israel came in and moved them out, and then they became enemies of the people of Israel. Now their culture, their pagan culture, was something that was a real thorn in the side of the people of Israel because they were continually drawn into it. But they became the enemies of Abraham's descendants when those descendants came in to take over the land. In addition to these Canaanite tribes that were occupying the land, we see that Abraham's own family also grew and began to add more population to the region. We saw in a previous discussion, we read of the birth of Ishmael in chapter 17. In chapter 17, we see the birth of Ishmael. It says in verse 11 to Hagar, his mother, it says, you are with child, you'll bear a son and call him Ishmael because the Lord has heard your affliction. He'll be a wild man. His hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him, and he'll dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So he was to be a little bit like Esau in the sense that he was maybe on the outside of the way society generally expected one to be. He was lived by his wits and lived by his violence. And yet he would remain essentially on the fringes of his family. Ishmael was to be a mighty nation, however, in chapter 17, verse 20. Abraham here has been arguing that God would, not arguing, praying and wishing that God would accept Ishmael as the son of the covenant. It says that God said that he would not, that he would establish his covenant with Isaac. But then it says in verse 20, as for Ishmael, I've heard you, and I've blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. So the descendants of Ishmael also begin now to populate this region, along with the tribes of Canaan. Then, of course, we have the descendants of Esau, as we read of his birth in chapter 25. And Esau also then began to expand, and his descendants were part of the population of this region. One of Esau's grandsons, by the way, was Amalek. And his descendants, the Amalekites, became one of the most bitter enemies of Israel. And we'll come across them when we continue. We see who they, the battle that the Amalekites had, and different battles they had against Israel, even from the very beginning of the nation of Israel. Amalek is mentioned in Genesis 36, verse 12. His birth is noted there. So we have the descendants of the Canaanite tribes, the descendants of Ishmael, the descendants of Esau, and we can also add into the mix the descendants of Moab and Ammon. In Genesis 19, beginning in verse 30, we see the birth of these two Moab and Ammon as sons of Lot. The Moabites and the Ammonites, as we will note, again, we'll come back to the specifics on this, but they began to populate the region as well, and they were also enemies of the people of Israel. But notice again that all of these are Abraham's immediate descendants. His son Ishmael, his grandson Esau, and his nephew's sons Moab and Ammon all became enemies of the descendants of Abraham that God was working through. But there's more. In Genesis 25, verses 1 through 4, we see that Abraham had six more sons by his wife Keturah, whom he took after Sarah had died. And says in chapter 25, verse 1, that Abraham took a wife, or again took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bore him, and lists the sons that came from that marriage. Verse 5, and Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. So Abraham has a second family. He had Ishmael, then he had Isaac. Now he has six more sons and possibly even more than that. But he gave all of his inheritance to Isaac. Isaac was the son of promise. Isaac was the one who would inherit the blessings that and the covenant that God had given or made with Abraham. But he gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, and he sent them away to the east. Now, it mentions that Keturah is his wife, and it mentions six sons by name. Then it says he gave gifts to the sons of the concubines. So it's kind of vague. Were there even more in addition to just Keturah and her children? Perhaps there were. But Abraham preserved the inheritance for Isaac. He gave his other sons some gifts and something to get started, and he sent them off to the east, it says, and to the east of the land of Canaan. Of course, you find areas that are now places such as Iran, Iraq, and so on, and that general area to the east. So we have a kind of a complex group of different peoples that are forming here. All of the Canaanites are there already, entrenched in their villages and in their civilization. The sons of Ishmael, Esau, Moab, and Ammon, and the other sons of Abraham as well. Already getting kind of crowded in the Middle East. But of all those that are there, God chose one family that he was going to work through. As he had in mind from the beginning in Genesis chapter 12, God chose Abraham and his descendants. Back in chapter 17, again, we're jumping back into the story here again. This is back just before Isaac was born. But we see the promise made once again that God is going to work through the descendants of Abraham. He was 99 years old, verse 1, when the Lord appeared to him. And he said, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly. Now at this point, Ishmael is probably about 13 years of age. He was born when Abraham was 86, it says at the end of chapter 16. So Abraham is most likely convinced that God is going to provide these blessings through Ishmael. I'll multiply you exceedingly. Abram fell on his face, and God talked to him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. God made his covenant with Abram and passed that along to the descendants of Abram. His name is changed to Abraham in the next sentence. And he says again, I will make you exceedingly fruitful and make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and your descendants after you in their generations. God's promise, as we heard earlier, which cannot be broken, he would never lie, he would never mislead, he would never go back on his word. He promised that he would make an exceedingly abundant nation of Abraham, and that kings would come. And I'll establish my covenant between me and your descendants after you and your generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also, I will give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. God was perfectly faithful in his to the covenant that he made, the promises that he made. And he promised that he would work through this one family, the descendants of Abraham. And as we saw a moment ago in verse 19, the son through whom God would carry out that promise and the covenant would be passed along was Isaac. To Isaac and his family, God would continue to work and work out his plan with them, with that line of descendants. Isaac, in turn, passed that blessing or that covenant blessing along to his son, Jacob. Of course, he didn't realize at the time he did it that he was passing it along to Jacob. He thought he was passing it along to the son that he loved, to Esau. But Jacob had disguised himself, as we find it in chapter 27 of Genesis, and tricked his father. Isaac was suspicious initially because he didn't anticipate that his son would be back so soon, and when he went out to get some fresh game. So Isaac was a bit suspicious. Verse 26, his father, Isaac said to him, "Come near now and kiss me, my son." And he came near and he kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing. His mother had helped him to disguise himself, and trusting his sense of smell, Isaac was convinced that this was Esau, when in truth it was Jacob. So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the smell of his clothing, and he blessed him, saying, "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed." Therefore, verse 28, and Isaac kind of based this particular wording, or the wording of this blessing, on the kind of person that Esau was. Esau smelled like a field, like an open field, and God would bless him in that as he would an open field. "Therefore God give you of the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine." And then he says in verse 29, "Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren." So we see here again that through this blessing, which is in a sense a prophecy, Jacob, who received the blessing, was to be the master over his brethren, over his family, other members of the family, his immediate brother Esau. And that would include as well the family that came through his cousins, who came through Ishmael, that Jacob was to be the master over all the others in his family. "And let your mother's sons bow down to you." This is part of the blessing that was given and the prophecy that was given regarding Jacob as he received that blessing. Now, as soon as this happened, of course, Esau returned for his blessing and learned that his father had been tricked into giving the blessing to his brother Jacob. Verse 34, when Esau heard the words of his father, that he had given the blessing to his brother, when Esau heard this, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry, and said to his father, "Bless me also, O my father." So we see again the distinct rivalry between the brothers and how they were in competition with one another. And Jacob stole the blessing. Esau begged for a blessing. And Isaac was kind of beside himself after his older son then begged him for a blessing also. And he said, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing." So Esau said, "Well, doesn't his name fit him, Jacob? For he supplanted me now twice. He took away my birthright, and now he's taken away my blessing." And he said, "Is anything reserved for me?" Well, Isaac said to Esau, "Indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren I have given to him as servants." So Jacob was to have dominance over, and his descendants would have dominance over the descendants of his family, specifically of Esau. "I've given him the blessings of wine and grain to sustain him. What is left now to give to you?" And Esau cried out, "Have you only one blessing? Isn't there one thing left for me?" Try to imagine how desperate Esau felt at this moment. He had lived all of his life struggling against Jacob. They had always been at odds. Jacob had taken advantage of him. And we find no evidence of any sort in this story that Jacob in any way favored or had any closeness in their relationship at all with Esau. In fact, as we saw, the family itself is divided. Father favors one and mother favors the other. And now after all that he's been through and all this difficulty they've had as brothers and as a family, Esau finds that the one hope that he had, receiving his father's special blessing, had also been taken from him. And his brother had been elevated to be his master, and he would serve his brother. "Isn't there anything left for me?" Esau cried. So Isaac answered, verse 39. And I'll read this from the New International Version. Isaac said, "Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven above. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother." That was the blessing that was left for Esau. You can see how it is that just a couple of verses later, Esau voiced his intent to kill his brother Jacob because of the fate or the way that he and his descendants would live in comparison to his brother. But notice at the end of verse 40, "But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke from off your neck." In other words, ultimately, Esau's descendants would break free of the domination of Jacob's descendants. It would be a relationship of continual confrontation and violence. He would live by the sword, serve your brother, apparently unwillingly. But there would come a time when Esau's descendants would break away and no longer be under that condition of serving the brother Jacob. So we catch a glimpse of some of the kinds of events that will take place yet in the future. But we'll talk about that more specifically when we get further along into the prophetic part of this story. For now, let's quickly follow through this one little bit more of the thread of the people of Abraham's descendants. Jacob goes on, as we know, to have 12 sons. They're listed in Genesis 29 and 30, the sons that are born to Jacob. And finally, his last son, Benjamin, whose birth is described in chapter 35. We also remember that Jacob's name, and this is an important detail, Jacob's name was changed. Abram was changed to Abraham. Jacob's name is also changed. We see in chapter 32, verse 28. Chapter 32, verse 28. On this occasion, Jacob had wrestled, as we know, with, it says, the angel of the Lord, or with the one who became Jesus Christ. And it was evidence of Jacob's determination. In this case, his aggressiveness was something that was helpful to him, because he was determined to receive a blessing from the one who we know later became Jesus Christ. I won't let you go unless you bless me. Verse 27, so he said to him, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name is no longer Jacob, but Israel. Your name is now changed to Israel, which means prince with God. One who rules with God or under God is what his name was changed to mean. For you've struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Your tenacity, your desire to receive God's blessing, and your unwillingness to let go without receiving it was rewarded with the blessing. But the key here is that his name was changed to Israel. So when we read later of the children of Israel, we're talking about the descendants of Jacob. The descendants of Jacob are the children of Israel. And we more typically refer to him as Jacob, although from his point on, or this point on, his name really is Joseph. He is Israel. Joseph is the next word in my notes here. So, we know the story. We're not going to take a lot of time to discuss it. One of Jacob's sons, Joseph, was sold into slavery in Egypt. And through Joseph, then, the rest of the family of Jacob came to live peacefully in Egypt. We'll see that thread in Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. Exodus, the first chapter, verse 1. These are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. And it lists the sons. In verse 5, all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Verse 6, Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. So time passes very quickly, as was noted, at least it's very quickly rehearsed here. And as time passed, that first generation that came into Egypt passed on. They died. But the children of Israel, the sons of the descendants of Jacob, were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. As new leaders came into power, they became fearful of this large family that had grown into a nation, the people of Israel. And they took control over them and dealt harshly with them. You read in the next several verses. The new king came over, took responsibility and didn't know Joseph. And he was fearful of the people. So he shrewdly, it says, brought them into subjection to him and they became slaves in the land of Egypt. But they had grown into a mighty nation. The people of Jacob, his descendants, had grown into a sizable number of people that now God would work with to begin to fulfill the covenant he had made with Abraham, to give the land of Canaan to the descendants of Abraham through Jacob, through his 12 sons. Chapter 2, verse 24. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, God hadn't forgotten. It hadn't slipped his mind. But it means that God was aware of, God recognized, God certainly was working toward the fulfillment all along. And now the time had come when he would begin to establish the descendants of Abraham in the land of Canaan. He would begin to fulfill that promise that he had made long ago to Abraham. Chapter 3, verse 14. Chapter 3, verse 14. God said to Moses, I am who I am. And so he's telling Moses who to tell the people he is. And this is his name, I am who I am. And thus you shall say to the children of Israel, to the descendants of Jacob, I am has sent me to you. Moreover, God said to Moses, this is what you'll say to the children of Israel. The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. And told him to go and gather the elders to tell them what God was going to do. Verse 17. I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and all the ites that are listed here once again. God is going to establish his people, fulfilling the promises that he had made to Abraham. The people of God were about to carve out their land from among the peoples who had begun to populate it, which included, as we reviewed, the sons and the immediate descendants of Abraham other than Isaac. It included the Canaanites and others such as the Philistines who now lived in that region. But it had been promised to the descendants of Abram from the very beginning. As we continue, we're going to see how the rivalry and the bitterness that started between Jacob and Esau affected the development and the establishment of ancient Israel. How they interacted in those times and how it fits the conditions today that we see in the hatred and the bitterness between the two dominant cultures that we find in the Middle East in particular. And we'll see later what prophecy indicates is yet to take place in the future. So we'll conclude here for now, and next time we continue with this, we'll pick up the story at its next stage and see how Israel confronted the people of the land and what it portends for the future of Israel and of the descendants of those that were in that region as well.
Thank you, Mr. Henson.